Well, this pandemic of the last 3 months has disrupted every aspect of society, and that has certainly included our life as a church family. Since this is our first Sunday officially back, I want to bring us something that I trust will help us to begin refocusing on our life as a church family, on our mission in serving the Lord in this world, on our relationships with each other as members of the same body. And as I've been thinking about what to say, my mind has been drawn to a passage that we all know very well, and that I'm sure we could quote pretty significant sections of. It's a passage we studied before here in our church, and I'm talking about the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. So let me invite you to go with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And I'll be reading through the different sections of this as we go along in our meditations this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. This is a familiar passage, one that you could quote, and that brings up the question as to why so many Christian people and even non-Christian people are familiar with the beautiful words about love in this chapter. I don't think it's that the average person has conducted a very careful and thorough study of the epistle to the Corinthians here. I think it's because this idea of love is such a foundational one, and just on the surface of it, this chapter appeals to us, it instructs us, it inspires us about such an important matter. And maybe it's well known particularly because it is commonly read at weddings, and it is often applied to the relationship of marriage. There is nothing wrong with that application. Actually, there's everything right about that application. I can say with confidence that a couple is going to enjoy a God-honoring and even a happy marriage if their relationship is characterized by the principles of love that the Apostle Paul lays out here. And in fact, those principles of love, they bear application to any kind of interpersonal relationship or interaction that we have with people. But what I want about marriage, and it is not about a number of the relationships in general that we might apply this passage to. In fact, when we apply a Bible passage to matters that aren't being directly addressed in that passage, here's what can easily happen, and it happens with other very famous texts as well. What can happen is that in our effort to apply it to things that are on our minds and hearts, we end up missing the original application in its context. The passage sort of takes on a life of its own, and it's separated from the overall book in which it occurs and the message of that chapter that the Lord originally intended. By focusing so much on a secondary application, we miss the main point of the passage. It just kind of gets left behind. And so we want to ask, what is the context of 1 Corinthians 13? And what is the main point of this portion of Scripture? Well, this chapter occurs in a letter that really does not sound like the sort of warm and fuzzy atmosphere that you expect in a wedding. It is directed to a church that had a lot of problems and a lot of questions that were dividing them. And in chapters 12 to 14, the specific issue that was troubling to the Apostle Paul, especially, was disorderly worship and an unedifying use of spiritual gifts. And Paul gives a lot of very specific, sort of step-by-step instructions about what they are to do in their gatherings and in their church life, and what they are not to do to avoid the kind of problems that they were going through. And right in the middle of that, as the overall tone and motive for all of these things he's teaching them, the Apostle Paul lays out what he refers to as a still more excellent way. That's the introduction to this chapter that shows up right at the end of chapter 12. I will show you a still more excellent way of living and interacting with the church family. And that more excellent way is all of this about love in chapter 13. He's urging them to pursue as the way, the best way, to resolve their struggles concerning spiritual gifts and church ministry and the like, that more excellent way is the way of love. In other words, this chapter on love has specifically to do with love inside of the local church. Those kinds of relationships. That context, that is the point of this passage. The love that ought to bring us together in unity despite any differences or disagreements. The love that should motivate the ministry that we do toward each other in gathered worship. The love that should drive all of our decisions as a church family and that should characterize our interactions with one another. And so this morning, I'd like us to consider this chapter as a way of renewing our focus on the love that we desire here and that for so long we have experienced here by the grace of God. And so the title of these thoughts is as follows, Renewing Our Focus on Love. It's kind of a reboot button. We've been away for so long, we've been apart from each other, and our lives perhaps have had to concentrate on so many personal things. Now we're gradually able to reconnect and to have times like this together and be more free to interact individually with each other. This is the word of the Lord for us as we do that. This is His guidance, renewing our focus on love, what this actually means and what this looks like. Not so much of a sermon that I want to deliver this morning, but more of a pastoral walkthrough, reflection, meditation, application of this passage of Scripture. And it's laid out in a very simple way, three distinct sections. I want to read each of them. I want to summarize what Paul is saying here and try to capture the essence of each part as we go along. And as we go into the first section, which is verses 1 to 3, as we go into that, I want you, in your mind, not out loud, but in your mind, to define what biblical love is. If we were to take audible answers or take a quiz on something like this, how would you answer that question? What is biblical love? And you're probably familiar with the Greek term that the New Testament uses to talk about these things primarily. It is that word agape. What does that mean? How would you define that? Maybe you would say that agape is the love of self-sacrifice. Of saying no to yourself in order to do something necessary or helpful for somebody else. And we do make an effort to move this agape love out of the realm of theory and out of the realm of emotion to the realm of concrete action, to where love is about doing things that are beneficial for other people. Love is about actions that are designed to meet the needs of others, even if it requires great cost to ourselves, that idea of self-sacrifice. Well, that idea would certainly be a dimension of biblical love and ultimately a part of the definition. And to express that, all I have to do is to quote a biblical line that's more famous than 1 Corinthians 13. It's the most famous passage in the Bible, John 3:16. I want to read that to you from the NET Bible. It says, "For this is the way God loved the world." This is the way God loved the world. "He gave His one and only Son, so that everyone who believes in Him, the manner that God loved or demonstrated His love was through an act of self-sacrifice, yielding up His Son to pay the penalty for our sin through his substitutionary death. And that sacrifice is not only the foundation for our own acceptance with God and eternal life, but it is as well the foundation for all of our acts of love. And yet this passage, for as much as it emphasizes self-sacrifice, does not actually define love in that way. To say that God loved by sacrificing is not the same as saying that love is fundamentally about self-sacrifice. That is its essence or its definition. It is a way that love is shown. But love is out here as a demonstration of something more deep and more profound than merely an action. And that is such an important distinction. It's actually the distinction that the Apostle Paul begins this chapter with in that first section. I'm going to read that to us in verses 1 to 3. And we see here the necessity of love. The necessity of love over and above even the most self-sacrificing thing that you might do to help somebody. Verse 1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. And what you see there is that the Apostle Paul is giving several illustrations of extreme actions, extreme self-sacrifice, that are designed to benefit other people and that are designed to advance the cause of Christ and to build up the church. In verses 1 and 2, what he deals with are issues that were very connected to the concerns at Corinth. He's talking about the exercise of spiritual gifts. And extreme forms, or just highly effective forms of ministry, whether it's tongues or prophecy or faith. And given that that was such a priority for the people of Corinth, Paul talks about that first, and he anything that the Corinthians could expect to be happening among themselves. They prided themselves on their wonderful and amazing and just over-the-top spiritual gifts in these areas, and Paul takes it to the nth degree, speaking hyperbolically of the most dramatic use of spiritual gifts imaginable. If somehow you can speak not only the tongues of men, but whatever language angels happen to speak. If your prophetic powers were so powerful that you could understand everything there is to know about God and turn around and teach it to people. Or if your spiritual gift of faith and confidence in the promises of God about specific requests that you pray were so powerful that it had the ability to remove mountains, all right? That's what he's dealing with, appealing to the kinds of things that they found to be very impressive. Verse 3 is broader. And there he gets into the idea of self-sacrifice in particular in the most extreme of ways. Giving away all that you have in order to meet the needs of other people. And even being willing to pay the ultimate price of death, delivering up your body to be burned in order to save someone else. Or just in terms of being willing to suffer persecution to the ultimate burn. Think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had to go through the fire because of their allegiance to the Lord, and the Lord spared them miraculously, but that's the concept, being willing to undergo that kind of pressure. And in fact, maybe even some of the people that were receiving this letter for the first time, before too long, would have to suffer persecution like that as well, as so many early Christians did. You talk about these kind of actions, ministry that is so powerful, or self-sacrifice that is so costly. It sounds so impressive. It sounds so godly. It sounds so loving. And yet, for as helpful and noble as those actions may appear, Paul says that you can actually do even the most extreme thing for other people, and for it to be counted as worthless as far as God's concerned. So you see how he's distinguishing between mere self-sacrifice, the action, between that and actual agape or love. What he's saying is that love has to do fundamentally with our motives, not our actions. It has to do with what is driving the actions. And the fact is, if we were to evaluate when we do sacrificial things for the wrong reason, what could some of those reasons be? We might do something self-sacrificing and that on the surface looks like love in order to make ourselves feel better as people. We might do it to salve our conscience about past failures. We might do it out of pressure of looking bad if we don't help others. We might do it in order to look better than someone else that we're jealous of. We might do it in order to gain a reputation as a loving person and to be honored for that. Or we might do it in order to gain some position or even some material advantage as the eventual result of our self-sacrifice. I'm sure that's not even a complete list of the kinds of things that could drive people to do the sort of ministry in these verses and yet lack love. The point is that love is not only about actions. It is not even primarily about actions that help other people. It is about what drives those actions, the motives of our hearts. And we really need to keep that in mind as we go into the next section. Because it's going to correct what I found to be a common misperception of verses 4 to 7. Here's what you read, even among some of the best preachers and commentators on this passage. You'll find things like this. That when Paul goes on to describe love in the next section, it is all in terms of verbs and things that love is or does. It is all in terms of verbs, and therefore, because it's about verbs, his focus is on actions and what love does in self-sacrifice. That's how often people conclude from those verses. Well, actually, that conclusion goes entirely against the point that Paul has just made in verses 1 to 3. It is not just about actions. That's not the definition or the essence of love. There's something else going on here in the nature of the verbs and the descriptions that he gives. And let me encourage you to be asking, what is he saying? If these are not actions that he is focusing on primarily, what is he getting at here? And so we move into verses 4 to 7 from the necessity of love to the description of love. And this is a part that we could quote. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on the way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Let's consider each of those descriptions. Here at the beginning of verse 4, Paul describes the general posture of love. And the first thing he says is actually passive in nature. Love is patient. It's not that it's going out and doing things. This is the idea of suffering long, of just staying quiet, even when you want to say something. It is tolerating other people, and especially tolerating when those people hurt you or when they annoy you. You're not so much going out and doing a bunch of things. You're just quietly, humbly suffering long. Now, one verb in this whole section that I believe gets at action to a significant degree is the next one, when it says love is patient and is kind. It is benevolent. It looks for ways to do good to people. And so I don't want to diminish the action side. There is something here about doing beneficial deeds. And yet, it's interesting the particular way that he describes it. He doesn't say simply love does good things or nice things for people. He says love is kind. Whether you're talking about the English word kind or the underlying Greek word, there's something more to that term than just being nice to people. It conveys a spirit of gentleness, a spirit of graciousness. This is about the attitude with which you do nice things for people. And in fact, sometimes we can detect when people are doing nice things for us, but they're not actually being kind. Sometimes we can see through that there isn't a spirit of genuine interest in us, and this idea of humble service and the heart desire to be a blessing. It's not really kindness if it's not accompanied by and driven by that sort of spirit. Again, it's not merely the action. And so those are the general postures of love, but as Paul goes on, really most of this little section here is about things that love does not do. Or you might say love's avoidances, the kinds of attitudes and actions that love avoids. It's not so much about what you do, but about what you don't do. Paul keeps repeating the word not as he goes on in verse 4 and through verse 6. And here again, we're going to see that what love avoids are fundamentally internal matters. Yes, they can often be seen in the way people react or don't react, but they're fundamentally matters of the heart. Notice and arrogance. Those are attitudes. Those are attitudes that can be clothed even while you're doing something nice for somebody. It has to do with being oriented to the satisfaction and the promotion of self. Envy, boasting, arrogance. Now let me make one caveat here that we might easily miss and overread this. And that is that not all self-orientation is wrong, nor is it contradictory to love. I want to remind us what it says at the end of verse 3, that Paul says, if he does these dramatic things but has not love, I gain nothing. And what that assumes is that he wants to gain something out of this. And he expects that other people are going to want to gain something out of it, even while they're giving. So it's not to say a total denial of self, or denial of self in every sense. Actually, true love returns back blessing to you. I read a quote recently that if you look back on your life, the time that you felt most alive and the time that you felt most joy and like your life amounted to something was the time when you were showing love to somebody. But there was this kickback effect that through that you enjoyed love yourself, or joy, or blessing, a sense of purpose. This is what Paul has in mind, that he wants to gain something himself, even while he's helping other people. So not every form of self-orientation is wrong. What he's talking about here, these terms, envy, boasting, arrogance, is what we would call selfishness. An excessive preoccupation with self, an exclusive focus on self, a pursuit of our own satisfaction apart from God and in ways that are dishonoring to the Lord. And again, these are all matters of the heart. And then he says, love is not rude. That does speak to your actions and to your words, but it is still a heart issue. What drives you to be rude? Maybe an over-individualism. Maybe a lack of concern for others and caring for them, or a sense of people are in the way of your agenda, seeking your comfort instead of making other people comfortable in a social situation. These are all manifestations of rudeness, but they all speak to your mindset and your attitude. He goes on to say, it does not insist on its own way. Focusing on your own opinions, on your own desires, and proudly unwilling to consider the perspective of other people, it is not irritable or resentful. That is selfishness as it comes out when you don't get your own way. So the first line there, does not insist on its own way, is pushing for your agenda. So how are you going to respond when you don't get your desires? Well, irritability and resentfulness. And then finally, it does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Again, that is something we could say you do, but joy is not really an action. Joy is a state of the heart. Joy is an internal experience. It has to do with what brings you pleasure or delight, whether it is wrongdoing or the truth. And so those are the avoidances of love. And finally, what I could say about verse 7 would be the commitments of love in Paul's description. Bearing, believing, hoping, enduring. And those verbs speak to the default mode or mentality when it comes especially to the difficulties that we sometimes run into in our relationships with people. We put up with their failures and foibles. We give them the benefit of the doubt instead of being hope-filled attitude, not because of their innate goodness, but because of the power of the grace of God that we're persuaded of. And we keep nurturing these attitudes toward them for the long haul. That's the idea of enduring. And note how consistently love moves you to respond in these ways. He keeps saying, all things, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Again, this is fundamentally a matter of your mindset and attitude. Those internal qualities do show themselves in how we act toward people, but the point is that they are still internal qualities. They're not essentially about actions. And then Paul rounds this out. He's talked about the necessity of love. He has given us the description of love. And then he makes these final comments about the priority of love in verses 8 to 13. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I have been fully known, so now faith, hope, and love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. And I'm not going to take the time to develop or to expound those verses, but I just want to emphasize his main point of the priority of love. And notice that he is prioritizing love over the very ministry activities and the very spiritual gifts that the Corinthians prized so much. Love is going to outlast these gifts that you're so taken up with. Tongues, prophecy, knowledge. Those ministries are temporary, but love is something eternal. And as if that weren't enough, Paul prioritizes love over other foundational Christian virtues. And things that are foundational in the sense that they're at the bottom, they're core, they're non-negotiable. They're part of the very definition of what, practically speaking, it looks like to be a Christian. And Paul takes these things that we know are so important, and he says, agape is of greater value than even faith and hope. It's a priority. And he's urging these people to prioritize it above other things that were so important to them. Well, what is the upshot of our walk? Thankfully, I don't think we have the same problems or the amount of problems that this church had. But as we re-engage in church life, in community life, this emphasis on love is vital. It is foundational. And I want us to be aware of many factors at this time that could easily work against our nurturing that kind of love and demonstrating that kind of love in our setting. Some of these things I bring up from time to time by way of encouragement. And that is that our church includes people of different backgrounds and personalities, and that is a good thing. You don't want a church of people that are just like you. We are all at different levels of spiritual maturity, and we are dealing every day with a variety of life problems and sin struggles. We have all failed our fellow believers in different ways in the past. And even though we're excited to be back together, as we should be, it may be that reconnecting is going to bring those past failures back to the surface. We might even have different opinions about the pandemic that's going on. And the best way to think about that, and the best way to respond to it as a church family, we might be all frustrated by this situation, but we might be frustrated by different parts of it. And that should be no surprise that we have difficulty coming to an agreement, because after all, for the last number of months, even the medical experts are divided about what's going on and how best to deal with it. To broaden that out further, we probably, in this day and age, in this weekend that we've been through, might have different ideas about the other kinds of social and political problems that are troubling, that are burdening our society, and what's actually going on, why these things are happening, and who ought to resolve them, how the government ought to go about dealing with them. And then if we could apply this kind of thing to other areas of life outside of our church family, I don't know, it may be that this pandemic has exposed brokenness in your own personal life or in your family, that has aggravated relationship problems within your family. And I would imagine that there are people who are coming to the Lord's presence this morning who are raw with wounds this morning, and who come to this place burdened down, confused, brokenhearted, have a way of affecting our posture and our interactions with other people. Well, this morning, I want to draw our attention to this teaching about love as the foundation for dealing with all these kinds of challenges. I want to put the emphasis where Paul does. And somebody might look at this idea of love and say, okay, everybody knows or should know that love is a choice. And so the point is, the message is, we need to make a choice and just decide to act in loving ways toward other people. Well, love does involve choice. There's no doubt about that. It involves daily choices. It involves moment-by-moment choices. But again, that is not what Paul is emphasizing here. The kind of love Paul is describing is not the kind of love that you just, by the force of mere willpower, decide, from now on, I'm going to do all these things or be all these things. Remember, it's not been primarily about actions. It has been about attitudes or inclinations or dispositions or affections of the inner person. And it is a humbling thing to come to the point where you recognize, I do not have access to my internal inclinations and just by all these things. Or other people, I can't put the switch and make them have this kind of heart either. Something deeper, something supernatural has to happen in order for this kind of disposition internally to develop and to grow within us. What has to happen? How do we go about, practically speaking, growing in love? I'm going to leave you with a few thoughts here. I hope that having gone through this today, we would at least be able to take the step of prioritizing the affections of the heart in our understanding of love and in our general approach to the Christian life. This is a point I make again and again in this church. What's going on inside? Are you evaluating your motives? What is driving you? Are you dealing with your affections? The loves that drive your choices? We don't want to overly focus on the actions. We want to address the inner person. So begin there. Just receive this truth and embrace the fact that we're talking about the need for a change of affections toward the Lord and toward other people. Secondly, one thing we can practically do is just to confess to the Lord. I can't make myself patient and kind. Sometimes I don't even want to be that way. Sometimes I don't even care. I don't naturally have these desires. And just come to the Lord and say that to Him. Express your utter reliance on Him. Tell Him that you can't make yourself feel this way toward other people. And having done that, there is a daily process of yielding yourself moment by moment to the influence of the Spirit. Now, I've dealt with 1 Corinthians 13 in different contexts, but one of the things that really struck me thinking about it this week is the parallel between what Paul says here and what he says two books later in Galatians, when he uses sometimes different words, but they are very overlapping. The description of love and the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5. And I bring that in to make the point, it is the Spirit that generates these things within us. This is the product, it is a fruit, it is the product of the influence of the Spirit within us. And we can guilt ourselves all we want and preach to ourselves all we want, but nothing fundamentally is going to change apart from the supernatural and sovereign work of the Spirit of God. And then to give them a heart and a desire for sanctification. And sanctification takes place as we are sensitive to His conviction, as we are sensitive to His prompting, as we follow the godly desires that He generates within us instead of following the desires that are generated by the flesh, Galatians chapter 5. Number 4, application. I would encourage our embrace trials as one of the tools that the Spirit uses to heighten our sense of need and to move us to rely on Him in the way that I've just described. Trials are not simply a quote-unquote fact of life. They're not simply an annoyance. They're not something to just kind of get over in order to get on with the essence of life. Trials would have to be one of the main tools that the Spirit uses to bring us to the end of ourselves, to where we admit that we don't have this, and that only by His grace and by moment, yielding of ourselves to His influence, can we come to develop these things in our hearts. And with that, we want to as well avail ourselves of the means of grace, the instruments that the Spirit uses to change us, chiefly the Word of God. We want to behold how Jesus demonstrated through all of His interactions with people the very Spirit that Paul is laying out here. Behold His love, not just in action, but in attitudes. Jesus told us what His heart was. You realize, I'm reading a book that makes the point, there's only one passage in all the Bible where God Himself says, this is the heart of Jesus. And it's maybe not what you would think. It is Matthew 11:29, where He says, I am gentle and humble of heart. It's the only place in the Scriptures where He actually defines or describes His heart directly. Gentleness, humility, graciousness, the desire to relieve the burdens of other people. This is 1 Corinthians 13. And as you and I draw close to Him and we sense more of that heart, His heart will gradually rub off on ours. And this is how, by God's grace, we grow and we renew our focus on love.